Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we're dipping into our archives. We'll hear from Jay Fleming about his book, Working the Water, which has now been published. We'll hear the story of the wreck of the HMS DeBrock, and we'll hear from Jim Rapp about the annual fall arrival of raptors on Delmarva. Photographer Jay Fleming has a particular passion for the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, including everything above and below the waterline, as well as the people who make their living off its bounty. He's finishing up a major project, publishing a book of over 300 of his photographs.
So Working the Water was a project that started 3 years ago. I first went out with Art Daniels. He's a waterman out of Deal Island. He's actually 94 this year. He just retired last year. But Art Daniels welcomed me aboard his Skipjack, City of Crisfield, which he's worked for over 60 years. And Art's just an amazing guy, a truly inspirational person. And Art kind of inspired me to start on this project because through Art, I was able to realize, you know, how many people depended upon the industry, on the seafood industry that is, and also, you know, that the industry was changing. And, you know, it was really important to document photographically guys like Art because they're living legends and, you know, they'll never be replaced. And they've seen things on the Chesapeake Bay that nobody else will ever see. The writing aspect of the book was difficult to sit down and find the time to write everything that I needed to write, but I felt like it was really necessary to kind of help describe the pictures, because there was only so much that we could include as far as the images went, and you know, you really have to use writing in the captions, and we have a lot of section introductions that we call them. We have 31 different subchapters and 4 chapters to the book, and each subchapter has about 2,000 words. So I guess you could say I'm passionate about the topics that I cover. You know, I have a passion for learning more about what I'm covering and you know, better understanding it and helping other people better understand what I'm shooting, because there's, you know, a lot of what I'm shooting hasn't recently been covered. It's been years since somebody's done a visual narrative of the Chesapeake Bay and the seafood industry. And I think, you know, even when they were done, they didn't really cover every fishery in detail. So I think, you know, my book is not only visually appealing, but it's very educational, because there's a lot of things covered in the book that a lot of people are unaware of. And I was out on Tangier Island earlier this week, and I brought the blue line proofs from my book out there. And I was showing it to some of the watermen I'm friends with out there, and some of them were, you know, they were learning stuff about different fisheries in the bay that they didn't know about, like snapping turtles. It's a 280-page book, so there's a lot of pictures, and I wrote about 15,000 words for the book too, based upon my experiences. So it's a lot of information as well.
Jay is becoming as well known for his underwater photography as his above water pictures. He knows his camera. He's able to capture just what he is seeing in pristine light and detail. His experienced eye prevents the need for a lot of retouching or processing of his imagery, whether using still photography or video.
I think a little bit of retouching on an image is necessary, like cropping a picture. If there's some distracting, like branch or, you know, just something in the way of the focal point that takes away from what you're looking at, then I'll you know, crop it if necessary. I'll adjust, you know, the lighting, you know, fill in some shadows, that type of stuff. But I really try to, you know, use the light as my kind of natural retouching tool, so I don't have to go back in and really work on the image. Sometimes it's necessary, you know, if you're just forced to shoot in bad light, like in the middle of the day, you know, say somebody's wearing a hat and there's a shadow, you know, casting down on their face and you can't see their face. Well, that's, you know, that might require a little bit of work, but, you know, as far as my post-production work goes, it's pretty minimal. I did start my photography in the darkroom, but quickly realized that I wanted to shoot in color. I really don't do any black and white. Occasionally I'll convert an image to black and white if it really needs it. And, you know, I try to incorporate color into every one of my photographs. So I really don't feel like my images translate very well to black and white, because that's kind of, you know, I'm going for the vibrant colors and, you know, the beautiful light in the morning and in the evening when I'm shooting outdoors. I think video has its place and still photography has its place. They're two completely different, you know, forms of art. I've recently branched off into video and started doing a little bit of video, and it's been a real effective tool for me to promote my still photography. And, you know, it's been an effective storytelling tool as well. And it'll never replace photography, but it'll always be a supplemental tool to help, you know, tell the stories that I want to tell.
Jay has several degrees, one in economics from St. Mary's College, and two others in natural resources and ecosystem conservation. His education gives him an informed appreciation and understanding of his subject matter. He learned photographic technique from his father, acclaimed Delaware photographer Kevin Fleming. Though he's still relatively young, his own artistry comes from personal experimentation over many years.
For me, composition was, learning composition was just a matter of trial and error. You know, just shooting a lot. I always try to go out 3 times a week to shoot pictures. Sometimes I don't get out that much, like when I was working on the book. But, you know, just shooting as much as possible has been the greatest teaching practice for me.
Jay's photography has the beauty of fine art, but his approach is that of a witness to the changing world around him.
I would say that, you know, I would consider myself more of a naturalist than an environmentalist. You know, I really, you know, try to look for stuff, you know, try to understand the ways that the environment works, rather than trying to, you know, push my agenda or my opinion. I really just strive to create like a accurate depiction of what's going on in the environment through my photographs. And you know, how people interpret them is up to them. I'm not trying to change any opinions through my photography, or you know, make any opinions for myself, but I would consider myself more of a naturalist.
Jay accepts commercial photography commissions. Much of this work has been for marketing materials for seafood companies. At the end of this month, on October 27th, from 5 to 9 p.m., Jay Fleming will have a book signing for Working the Water at the Chesapeake Heritage and Visitor Center in Chester, Maryland, where you can also see an exhibit of his photographs. While you're in that area, stop by the Queen Anne's County Center for the Arts in Centerville. They provide a wide array of art experiences and opportunities for emerging and established artists. And if you're hungry while you're in Centerville, stop by Doc's Riverside Grill for a cold beer and a great steak. Find links and details for Jay's book signing and other cultural events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. It's time for our first break. Stay tuned for the tale of the sloop HMS DeBrock that wrecked in the Delaware Bay in 1798. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. It's not surprising that there would be many legends of sunken ships with lost treasure in a coastal region like ours. But these stories have mostly spun disappointment from the thin straws of truth rather than any golden fortune waiting to be found. One shipwreck which has inspired such tales was that of a sloop of war called the HMS DeBrock. She started out as a single-masted sailing vessel, which was most likely built before 1781, probably in the Netherlands. Her name means the beagle. The Dutch were fond of naming their boats after dogs, and the Beagle was known to be small and fast, like the De Brock. She enters the history books in 1793 when she was assigned to sail with a Dutch squadron defending the coastal city of Willemstad during hostilities with France. Next, she was ordered to help escort a merchant convoy headed to the West Indies. On her way, she put into the English port of Plymouth, planning to take on supplies before heading south. But fate intervened. At about that time, the British declared war on the Dutch, confiscating the De Brock along with several other Dutch vessels. The boat was then refitted with a second mast and essentially rebuilt to satisfy the priorities of the British Navy at the time. Once the ship was outfitted with new cannons, she was also assigned a new captain. James Drew had a rather dubious reputation both professionally and personally. He had sired an illegitimate child and then ran off to marry a wealthy American girl. His first promotion to captain a ship ended quickly in demotion. In June of 1795, despite his so far poor military record, he got his first real chance to prove himself as a captain when he was assigned the De Brock. They were deployed to protect the British merchant fleet. Captain Drew and his crew managed to survive a number of naval skirmishes and storms at sea before being assigned to escort a group of vessels with trade goods heading to Delaware Bay. On the way there, near the Azores, the De Brock was ordered to fend off what appeared to be a French privateer approaching their squadron. This and an oncoming storm caused the ship to lose sight of the rest of the convoy. For 7 weeks, the De Brock disappeared. This is where all the fact and fiction start to diverge. One now discounted story was that Captain Drew had been under secret orders to carry government payroll money to Jamaica. Though he was not known for his daring, what actually happened was that he and his crew captured a Spanish ship called the Don Francisco Xavier, which was headed to Cadiz with a South American cargo valued at £160,000. It was common for British ships to attack and seize the civilian vessels of countries the Crown did not like. This so-called privateering was profitable both for the Crown and for the ship's crews who got to keep a portion of any valuables seized. In this case, it was an improbable yet noteworthy achievement for a small ship with a less than stellar captain. If you've just joined us, this is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and you're listening to the story of the wreck of the HMS De Brock. With the captured ship in tow, the De Brock sailed into her original destination, Delaware Bay, on May 25, 1798, unbelievably just hours after the rest of their convoy had already departed. A pilot boat master named Andrew Allen boarded the De Brock and met with Captain Drew to make arrangements for assisting the ship into port. But Captain Drew and his men were celebrating their arrival with a few beverages. They were not in any mood to take advice from Captain Allen, who left the ship to tend to more pressing duties, getting his own boat ready for a gathering storm now visible on the horizon. The foul weather came up very quickly, and in a freak event, a sudden, extraordinary gust of wind flipped the De Brock. Some of her crew was able to swim to safety on the Spanish prize ship, but Captain Drew, the rest of their mates, and some prisoners were swiftly pulled under to perish at the bottom of the bay. 47 men died that day. Now, if there was any treasure, most of it certainly sailed away on that Spanish vessel. The paymaster from the De Brock, Lieutenant Thomas Griffith, was on board with orders to make way to British authorities near Cape Henry should the two ships become separated. Historians presume that is what happened. The British consul in Philadelphia was informed of the disaster, and they sent two salvage brigs to raise the sunken ship. This actually contributed to the rumors of treasure since the boat was relatively small and would never really be seaworthy again, at least not for the purposes of the British Navy. So why were they going to all this trouble? It may have been in response to stories of the surviving sailors who were said to have paid for rooms in local hotels with gold doubloons. For some time, the ship's mast was visible above the water at low tide, so there is also a good chance that some strong swimmers may have been able to dive from boats to scavenge a few things. The British eventually wrote the De Brock off as a total loss. The mast fell, and the sands on the bottom of the bay shifted over the wreckage. But now a legend and a question had been created, capturing the imagination of treasure seekers for years to come. Was their South American gold still on the wreck at the bottom of the Delaware Bay? Over 30 attempts to find and raise the Debrock failed until the 1980s. Located with sonar, she was finally lifted out of the water with a crane. This was accomplished only after two competing companies fought in court to work the wreck. Sadly, the company that won the right to excavate the ship was accused of going about this work in a very haphazard way. Some observers reported that the salvage team simply threw overboard anything that did not look like treasure. The firm was also criticized for their improper disposal of the human remains. The outcry from the archaeological community was very loud. It led to the enactment of the 1985 Federal Abandoned Shipwrecks Act, which enables states to claim and protect the historical integrity of shipwrecks located up to 3 nautical miles offshore. Ultimately, the state of Delaware was awarded 1/4 of the salvage, and they purchased the rest for $300,000. Portions of the hull, along with over 20,000 artifacts, eventually found a home at the Zwanendael Museum in Lewis. Among them is the ship's original muster roll listing the members of the crew and their home ports. The rest of the collection tells the story of sailors' lives through objects from their everyday life, including china, shoes, a bottle marked ketchup, a wig, and a ring belonging to Captain Drew, which held an inscription that commemorated the death of his brother, who had also been lost at sea. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On October 8, 1916, the first boat went through the Lewis-Rehoboth Canal. This had been authorized by the U.S. River and Harbor Act of 1912 and had taken about 3 years to complete. And on October 8, 1903, a tropical storm ravaged Ocean City, Maryland, destroying several properties, including 2 hotels. It looks like we will dodge Hurricane Matthew, which should make folks happy in Trapp, Maryland, where they are celebrating Uncle Nace's Day. This event was named for Nathaniel Uncle Nace Hopkins, a freed slave who served in the Union Army during the Civil War and afterward helped organize other newly freed blacks, build schools and churches. He also founded what became an annual parade to commemorate the date, November 1, 1864. That is when slaves in Maryland were fully emancipated. President Lincoln's proclamation of the previous year actually only freed slaves in the states that had seceded. The new Maryland Constitution made it one of the first U.S. states to officially abolish slavery through a popular vote. Uncle Nace's Day is held in Trapp every year on the second Saturday of October, which, as you know, is today. They had a church service this morning, and a parade is at 1 p.m. Find out more about Delmarva's heritage on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. It's time for another break now. When we come back, we'll hear the October Garden Planner and all about hawks and other raptors visiting Delmarva this time of year. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. We're so glad you've joined us today. Here's Scott Duncan with the October Garden Planner and some tips for putting your garden to bed for the winter.
In October, we begin preparing the garden for spring. Plant crocus, daffodils, peonies, poppies, irises, and other spring-blooming bulbs or tubers. Before the first frost, bring in potted houseplants and herbs. Help them get used to the change by first putting them on a covered porch for a few days, and then bring them inside. Keep your herb garden going all winter indoors. Woody herbs like oregano and thyme can be propagated from cuttings. Seeds from others can be started in potting soil. Fall is a good time to start cutting back invasive weeds, along with diseased or dead shrubs and trees. If you're using pruners on infected materials, be sure to clean them before moving on to the next plant. Dip them in a solution of 1 part bleach to 9 parts water. If there is no disease present, leaves and small twigs can be used to build up your compost. Leaves of perennials and trees help create a really rich compost to mix into your flower beds come springtime. Divide and transplant perennials and ground covers. When cutting back many of your woody perennials, leave a stem of at least 6 inches so that you know where they are in the early spring. For all other perennials, mark them with stakes. Add a 3-inch layer of mulch to those parts of your garden that are particularly exposed to the harsh winter elements. This will help keep winter weeds down and possibly bring back some of those plants that might not normally winter over. Plant bare root trees, shrubs, ground covers, and vines now, before freezing temperatures, or wait until spring.
Thanks, Scott. Visit our website for hardiness maps and links to your cooperative extension office and other gardening resources. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/gardening. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about the fall migration of raptors to our region.
As the long sunny days of summer get shorter and fade into the cool nights of early autumn, thousands of migrating raptors will travel south through Delmarva on their way to their wintering grounds in the Caribbean and Central and South America. This is the time of year for fans of these charismatic birds of prey to pack their binoculars and spotting scopes and head to one of the region's famous Hawk Watch platforms. Raptors are the group of birds that includes hawks, falcons, eagles, and ospreys, and are known for hunting and feeding on other animals. Vultures, known more for eating carrion, are also included in this group. The term raptor is derived from the Latin word rapere, meaning to seize or take by force. Strong grasping feet equipped with sharp talons, a hooked upper beak, and excellent binocular vision characterize these avian predators. Hawkwatch Hill, located at an elevation of 260 feet at the Ashland Nature Center in Hockessin, Delaware, just north of Newark and Wilmington, is an ideal place to watch raptors as they soar over the rolling hills on this eastern edge of the Piedmont down to the valley floor of Red Clay Creek. Hawkwatch Hill is in the center of the Red Clay Audubon Important Bird Area, designated by the National Audubon Society. At the Hawkwatch, visitors are welcome to watch the raptor spectacle from early September until the end of November. Birders can help the full-time hawk watcher and trained volunteers look for the 5,000 to 10,000 raptors that fly over the hill during the months of autumn. The Ashland Nature Center serves as the headquarters for the Delaware Nature Society, one of Delmarva's leading conservation and environmental education organizations. Founded in 1964, the Delaware Nature Society works to improve the environment through conservation, advocacy, and education. They manage more than 2,000 acres of prime Delmarva wildlife habitat, including 4 nature preserves and 3 nature centers. In addition to the Hawkwatch, a trip to the Ashland Nature Center in the fall offers 130 acres with nature trails to explore forest, meadow, marsh, and the Red Clay Creek. Ashland is open year-round and features family education programs, a picnic area, and a lodge for overnight youth groups. Most of Delmarva spreads south far below the Ashland Nature Center, but many of the raptors that cruise over Hawkwatch Hill use the peninsula as a migratory superhighway. Between the eastern Delaware Bay and the barrier islands along the Atlantic coast, and the broad expanse of Chesapeake Marshes to the west, the peninsula narrows dramatically as you approach the southern tip at Cape Charles, Virginia. As the peninsula narrows, Delmarva becomes a funnel for huge numbers of migrating raptors and other birds. Exhausted migratory birds don't like flying over the open water, and many will rest up and feed before crossing the Chesapeake on their way towards the Carolinas. Another great spot for hawk watching is located at Kiptopeke State Park near Cape Charles on Virginia's eastern shore. It is one of the best places in the world to view migrating peregrine falcons and merlins, with records of more than 350 birds in a single day. Kiptopeke also features a raptor and songbird banding station managed by the Coastal Virginia Wildlife Observatory. Hundreds of birds are caught, examined, fitted with a leg band, and released each season. The peninsula funnel effect also drives birds south from the tip of Cape May, New Jersey, to the hawk watch located across the Delaware Bay at Cape Henlopen State Park near Lewis, Delaware. This oceanside hawk watch is found on an elevated platform sitting on top of a World War II bunker. Some of the raptors counted here include several species of hawks, including red-tailed, red-shouldered, broad-winged, Coopers and sharp-shinned hawks, bald and golden eagles, turkey and black vultures, kestrels, merlins, and peregrine falcons. Now and then, Mississippi kites and swallow-tailed kites fly over. Hawk watch totals from Ashland, Kiptopeque, and Cape Henlopen are reported to the Hawk Migration Association of North America, a national group that collects raptor count data from almost 200 hawk watch sites throughout the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Hawk watch data is critical to understanding raptor migration and assessing their needs so that vulnerable populations can be protected. The best time to visit one of Delmarva's hawk watches is early to mid-morning after a cold front has passed through. The northwest winds provide a strong tailwind for migrating raptors and drive many birds towards the Delmarva coast. Young birds appear on the coast more than seasoned adults because their orientation is much less precise. The percentage of young birds tallied or banded at our coastal hawk watches is much higher than at stations further inland. Before migrating, raptors need to bulk up by adding up to 20% of their body weight in fat, which becomes high-powered migration fuel. Larger species with broad wings, such as eagles, vultures, and large hawks, conserve energy by taking advantage of updrafts and thermals when migrating up to 300 miles each day. They are rarely seen flapping their wings when they appear over Delmarva's hawk watch sites. A group of these raptors is referred to as a kettle when they ascend quickly to thousands of feet in the air and then glide down in the direction of their destination. Smaller hawks, falcons, and ospreys migrate by soaring and employing more active flapping flight during migration. These species will hunt in the early morning or late afternoon to fuel their journey south. At the Ashland Hawk Watch, other species of wildlife can be viewed throughout the season. On a beautiful day in early autumn, hundreds of migrating monarch butterflies fly past Hawk Watch Hill. In October, thousands of tree swallows form large swarms over the meadows. As the temperatures cool in November, Canada geese, snow geese, and tundra swans can be seen migrating south by the thousands. Plan your trip this fall to the Ashland Nature Center, or head south to Cape Henlopen or Kiptopeque State Park, or visit all three to experience the spectacle of raptor migration on Delmarva.
Thanks, Jim. Check out our website to find out about nature events in your area of the peninsula. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/nature. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.